I'm going to talk more about communication. And so I've come up with this little cartoon thing. We've got these two of the best slides I've ever made, so you're allowed to go ooh and ah about that. So what happens is this guy comes home from work. Is that trouble? You having trouble reading that, Trey? Yeah. Okay, because I can read it out to you if you like. Anyway, this guy comes home from work and he's feeling lots of self-doubt and he doesn't know what to do. He takes himself out into the shed and he's fixing the lawnmower as his way of figuring out, how do I earn enough so that we can have another child? Right? Income is not great. Work is not great. He's out in the shed. Because men are not taught how to, what's the subject for today? Men are not taught how to communicate. Men, what women are taught, talk it out to work it out. Men are taught, work it out, then speak. If you haven't worked it out, shut up. So what's he doing in the shed? It looks like he's fixing the lawnmower. What he's actually doing is fixing the lawnmower as a way of working it out. Now, if you're a bloke, you understand this. If you're a woman, you'd go, why would you try that when you could just talk? So, do you understand what the situation that I've described? Okay. So, he's concerned about the lack of income that he's bringing in so that they can afford to have another child. What that tells you is he loves this girl, wants to have another child with her, wants to grow their family. Everything's perfect except the amount of money, and he's saying it takes money to bring up another child, which, if you think about it, in the first 5 years, costs you nothing. So he's, how far into the future is he? 5 years. Okay. All right. What do you reckon's happening for her? I say her. Could be a him. What's happening for her, do you reckon? I've chosen this one. She's decided that he's figuring out how to tell her that he's leaving her. Because he's not talking to her. If he's not talking to her, it must be bad news. What's the worst news for her? Her particular story is abandonment. Therefore, she's turned it into, if he's going to do something bad, he won't rob a bank and he won't have an affair. He'll leave me. Because why is he leave me the one that tortures her? Because she's been left before. Does that make sense? Her story is running now, but it's running independent of him. Her sense of powerless means that she's going to try and fix it by cooking his favorite, happens to be expensive, meal. Now, he's going to come out of the shed and
spend time with her enjoying that meal.
Spend time with her enjoying that meal, except that he's already wound up and she's already wound up. What is the emotional condition that he's in? Stress. What is the emotional condition she's in? Stress. So what's going to happen is he's going to come out of the shed, see the expensive meal, and blow a gasket. Because not only are we not making it financially, but you're wasting it. We didn't have to have this. What's wrong with spaghetti? So far, so good. Why is that? Why is it going to go that way? Because that's the story that was running before the event. Got that? Okay. So this just leaves this fear of he's not going to make it happening. So what does he do? The chances are, he's going to look at her blowing this extra money on the meal, and the emotion that men thought they can most often go to is, I'm giving you a hint, anger. So he's going to blow a gasket about that. So he sees the meal, he becomes frightened that they're never going to make it financially. And the way that men display anger is, sorry, the way that men display fear is they get angry. So she plops a good meal on the table, he blows a gasket, and he's got no idea that he's actually trying to scare his own fear away. But what's going on for her? She's scared. So what happens is that she drops into hurt. That leads to what? What's the most condoned emotion for women? The most condoned emotion for men is anger. The most condoned emotion for women is sadness. You got to pick between anger, sad, fear. Okay, so this means that he hates her and he's definitely leaving her. Does that, to her, that's what it means. Does that fit? Okay, so if she's going to be abandoned, as opposed to he goes and does something or blah, 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 then for her, he's going to abandon her by having an affair. He's not going to rob a bank. That wouldn't hurt her as much as. So she imagines that he's having an affair with another woman, and her fear of abandonment basically creates a whole idea that this is all a done deal. She can never compete with this other woman because... Because she's fabricated, you can't compete with her. She doesn't exist. You can't beat her. So, it's inevitable. So what happens is that she can't stop crying. Because she can't stop crying because of the sadness from... Remember, none of this is actually happening, and he wants to have more kids. Right? So she can't stop crying because of the abandonment that she experienced earlier in her life. This is Paul and Mary again. You guys got that, didn't you? It's just a different version. Okay, so what happens is that he concludes that he'll never understand women. They just do this weird-ass shit that you can't work out and you can never predict what's going on. You can't live with them, but you can't live without them. So I don't know what to do. Maybe it's better if they don't stay together, and he thinks, oh, bugger it. And he goes for the ultimate solution, which is... I'll think about this tomorrow. Right now, I'll have a beer. Because he's powerless to stop her tears. Because men are taught, if you're going to be any use at all, you fix things. Because he can't fix her, he feels powerless. As a consequence of feeling powerless and weak and useless, he gets even angrier, because that's bringing up his sense of inadequacy. That sense of inadequacy simply means that he's cranky with her and him. So he's now crankier. Got it? She says it's the beer that makes him crankier. What the beer's actually done is diminished the inhibitions, and the real cranky is coming out. That fit? Okay. So we don't have a problem in our culture with alcohol. We have a problem with anger released when alcohol. So what happens is we got a couple of broken hearts, and she wonders if he's becoming an alcoholic because whenever he can't solve a problem, he has a beer. That's not too often, but she thinks, how do you find solutions in beers? And so she says maybe her and the kids would be better off without him because he's becoming an alcoholic anyway. And she resigns herself to their fate. She gets ready for him to leave. She cries all day. He can't stop her, so he gets the shits with that, and they split. Got it? What would be the solution? A structured conversation. So let's have a look at how that might go. Do you like this? I hope you do, because that took like a day and a half, that slide. All right. However, how often do we see this in our culture? 100 times a day. When you look at that, you're looking at the base. This is the reason for the existence of the Global Success Academy, is that there's no shortage of clients. The divorce rate is 2 out of 3. These are two people who get together, and they love each other and they want to make it work. Look at this thing over here. What was he doing in the shed? He was wondering, how do we have more kids? And feeling hopeless because he didn't have the money. His personal failure rate, personal sense of failure is a contributing factor. Her abandonment stuff is a contributing factor. These guys were never going to make it, but they could.
So start. So at the start, she should have asked him why he was in the shed, and he should have asked her why the meal, because they were both different to what they normally do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly. Rick said the structured conversation. We're going to look at it because I was doing so well with cartoons, I thought, let's go again. All right, so this is the same thing. All right, that's the same box. That's the same text box. He's gone in the shed. You understand it? Yeah, nothing different there. And so this is the same text box. He's wanting to have kids. He just doesn't know how to express his level of failure. So that's the same as what we started with on the other slide. This time what she does is that she goes out there, she gives him some space. In other words, she doesn't rush out there behind him saying, what are you doing going in the shed? She leaves him out there for a while. Why would leaving him out there for a while be a good idea?
Just to let him go through the process that he needs to.
He needs the processing time because men are slow to work out what's going on for themselves. Right? The processing takes longer. If she goes out there too soon, they might have a fight about, I never get any space, when they need to be talking about something else. So she gives him a bit of space. Then she says, first part of structured conversation is, when is now a good time or some other time, but we need to talk. Then what she does is she inquires about what's bothering him. She asks a question. Got it? If she were to provide some wisdom, like, you're always coming out in there here in the shed and leaving me on my own, and what are me and the kids supposed to do when you're not around? Can you see that going anywhere? No. So what she has to do is put her agenda aside. So this could be either one of them, by the way, but in this situation, if she inquires about what's going on for him, that's a question. It means she's controlling the conversation and she can keep it on track. It means her own desires have to be put aside for a moment. And that is, I don't see enough of you because you're always out here in the shed. That makes sense? Okay. So, she knows that he might have to talk it out to work it out. She's aware of that. So, she stays out of her stuff by reminding herself that she needs to hear him out. That's pretty much what I said before that yellow box came up, and that is, you're not going to get anywhere unless your stuff can be delayed, put aside. You can't be left alone forever. It has to be brought up at some point. But does it have to come up now? Well, if you want to get the most from your partner, well, it can come up later. Your stuff can come up later. So she gets him talking about his stuff. And so eventually he says what's bothering him, and that is, it might take him a while to figure out that he's just generally cranky, but he doesn't know why. But as long as she keeps him talking by asking questions, eventually it comes down to the fact, well, it's just not enough money. I'm working too hard and we're not getting anywhere. And the consequence of that is that talking and responding to her leads him to his own self-judgment and feelings of failure. In other words, he's revealing to her that he feels inadequate. This is a treasured environment now because why? Why is this a sacred place?
They're working through it and they're actually working it out rather than getting just cranky.
Yeah, so they've stepped away from cranky. They're working it out. The reason it's a sacred space is by holding back, she's allowed him to step into the truth of his experience, which is, I feel inadequate. I feel whatever. Would it make sense that he would feel vulnerable saying that? Like, how many people would you say this to? Rarely do we say it. Therefore, the trick in this whole thing is that what's happened as a consequence of listening is that he's stepped out in the open. The barriers are down now. If the barriers are down, we're going to see magic. And so What she needs to do is not reassure him that he's okay. What we most want to do is make people's problems go away. When he says, I'm feeling hopeless, I'm feeling inadequate to the task, I'm just a failure, if she reassures him, then she's being like his mother, telling him he's good and he's not to, you know, she's telling him to ignore his truth. At that point, his truth is, I'm hopeless. When you tell someone to ignore their truth, you're not going anywhere. That conversation will become ridiculous. So, if she keeps asking for more, do you remember that bit? This is the magic question. In the structured conversation, what's the magic question? We've got an amazing bit of truth. Is there more? Is there more about that? What's going to happen then is the invitation to stay out in the open and to dig deeper is irresistible because there's gold happening now. Because there's gold happening now, then what happens is that she can allow herself to show empathy and say, what have you thought about in terms of solutions? Does that make sense? She's not saying what she thinks they should do. She's saying, what have you considered? What other thoughts have been running through your mind about how to solve this? And between them, they can come up with something. Do you reckon that's ever happened?
Rarely.
I'll tell you where I've seen it constantly. Not constantly. I'll tell you where I've seen it repeatedly. And that's when the disaster's big enough. So when I was doing the counselling for the people who lost houses in the bushfires in 2003, 500 houses burnt to the ground. I got to deal with maybe 100 of those people. And what I saw over and over again was that the devastation, when it was enough, brought them to this. You see, when you've both lost everything and you can share that you've lost everything, when you can share what that feels like, you understand two people, husband and wife, lost everything, might be feeling differently about it. So what we have to do is make our partner safe to express how their version of that sounds like. When that happens, when these two people can safely express how they feel about the loss of everything, it doesn't take long before they start talking about, well, what do we do now? We've lost everything is looking back. What do we do now is looking forward. And they start to come up with solutions. In all of the counselling I did in the bushfires, I didn't find one solution that I was able to give anybody. I was there on multiple occasions where they found solutions themselves. And they found them out of having nothing. And realising what they had was each other. The amazing thing about losing everything is, happened to Mary and I, the thing that turned Mary and I was this bushfire came through at our place at Warrenora and we saved the house but realised we could have lost it. And as trees were crashing around us the rest of that night, you know, the rest of the night, the fire was gone but everything was still smouldering. And so all the way through the night that night, I don't think we slept because every now and then a tree would burn through and fall over and crash. So it'd be every half an hour or so. And we were snuggled up together saying at least we've got each other. And we actually had all of our possessions. We didn't lose anything. But we'd faced it. Does that make sense? When you face losing everything or you realise you've lost everything, it makes you realise that the thing that you treasure most is each other or the relationships or the thing that you've learnt. So inevitably what happens is they start to figure out solutions. Some of these solutions will work and some won't, but there's a chance now. There's something to do. Where we get into trouble is where there's nothing to do. So hope and companionship arise. Out of those two, hope and companionship is far more valuable than hope. Because hope can lead to disappointment, but companionship, permanent. So that builds teamwork and togetherness and away they go. And so what happens is that we end up in a situation where the structured conversation leads to healing. And out of a disaster, we can create something good. So his feelings of failure, which go back into his childhood, they get healed because he's talking about it openly. He discovers that he's actually more than his results, and feeling like a failure is actually just an interpretation of results and not got nothing to do with the quality of the human being that he is. Her fear of being left is healed, and she's freed from the grip of an old enemy because she didn't get left when things were dark. Got it? That's the structured conversation put into the same situation we looked at before. Cool with that? Okay, yeah. What's it involve? What's it need? The solution here, the trick, the bottom line thing, the structured conversation. Got it? Okay. So, got an exercise for you. Those of you at home with a pen and paper, grab a pen and paper. What stories of yours collide with others more than others? You guys can work in pairs. We've got about 2.5 minutes now. What do you know about yourself, story-wise, that collides with the others out there, creating the difficulties in your life? Yeah, this is all of your life, so not just your partner. Like the obvious stories are the ones with your partner because it's constant. But what stories are being do you propagate out there in the world that actually create these collisions where conversations go bad because of these stories turning up? You don't have to explain why. You just have to notice. This is an act of observation. You've got 2.5 minutes. Ready, set, go. Okay. Let's have a look.
Well, Bronwyn Walker has asked me to read something to you. She said she's heard the loss of a child often causes separation rather than coming together. Can you ask PB about that when it suits? And I said, what's the specific question? And she said, can you just read him the statement of what I've heard as above and ask if it's correct? Often stories are not true.
So because I burped in the middle of that and I heard the burp and not the key word, am I describing how couples split when the loss of a child? Because that is a very common thing.
She's just asking if it's common. I asked for a specific question. She said just reading the statement and asking if it's true.
Yeah, I'm asking whether I heard the whole statement. So let me put it to you this way, Bronwyn, and for everybody else as well. Thanks for the question. It's a pretty smart question. What it boils down to is this. The way number of people who split after a SIDS episode is horrendous. It's like way north of 90%. So what that means is a child is lost, particularly with SIDS, a young child, where there's so much hope and that sort of stuff going on. Because men are taught that the most acceptable emotion for them to experience is anger, and because women are taught the most acceptable emotion for them to display is sadness, I think I might have said men experience, I mean men display. So what happens is that both the male and the female, both of the couple are experiencing extreme loss and grief. But it is likely to be displayed by the male as anger and displayed by the female as sadness. What that means is they don't connect because they start to argue about who should be sad or crying. And typically what happens is that he's a ball of anger because he's ripped off, right? So God or the universe or someone took away his dream. And so he's heartbroken. That shows itself both to him and to the rest of the world as anger. And so he's a ball of anger looking for a place to happen. He gets in fights and arguments and whatever. And just cranky to be around. One day he comes home and he notices that she's parked the car on the hose fitting at the end of the hose. She's broken the hose fitting, cost $6. And that's the trigger and he goes off like crazy. He comes inside ready to strangle someone and there she is on the lounge crying, which he's been doing for what feels to him like forever but is probably just a couple of months, maybe 3 months or 4 months, which is nothing in terms of loss and grief, but for him it's been feeling like forever because he can't fix it. So her being sad fires him up more, and so he unloads on her about parking on the hose and breaking the fitting and costing a fortune and blah, 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 and it's not really that it cost a fortune, but, you know, you're just not paying attention and whatever. And then she goes at him about you're behaving badly and that's not good, and you're behaving badly because really you're sad, which is probably true, but he doesn't want that to be true because he doesn't like it, because men are taught that sadness is a sign of weakness. So he gets more angry, and so what happens is that they exacerbate the situation with each other and they split. So essentially you will see lots of splits based on one issue experienced through different channels of emotion. The example I'm using is him displaying anger when he's actually grief-struck, and her displaying sad when she's grief-struck. And so they go apart because they can't be together, because being together is like pouring petrol onto a fire. So the split is kind of like to save themselves, really. It's just to sort of save more hurt and drama and anger. Hopefully that's an answer to the question. There are a million versions of that. So that same thing, that same emotional dichotomy can be experienced because of anything. It doesn't have to be a death of a child. It could be a car smash. It could be a terminal illness. It could be someone getting fired from work or made redundant. It could be a career ending. It could be the death of a parent or a relative. You know, it could be moving house. You know, some people find moving house that triggers that kind of thing. I know that for us, our personal experience for Mary and I was that, having lived at our farm for 30 years, I was ready to go and move to the water. It took Mary 7 or 8 years to adjust to that idea because she'd put her roots in the ground. So different experience of the same thing. We end up moving here, but it was really a matter of we had to work through the whole thing about what are you actually experiencing.
Bronwyn Walker said, that makes sense, thank you. Bronwyn O'Brien said, for years I did not feel loved by my husband, even though I knew he was loving me the best way he knew how. Then it dawned on me that I wanted and needed him to show me love in her way, and that this was stopping me of receiving his love his way. Now I see and experience his love the way that he shows it, and all it did was simply took me to change my thinking.
The world is going to change when you change your thinking. What we want is we want to keep our thinking the same and the world to change. Wouldn't it be better if, you know, they ought to do this and that should happen, and if only the this and the that, and, you know, you can get any target group you like to change. But, you know, whether that's the Christians, the Muslims, the politicians, the teachers, the nurses, the doctors, the police or whatever, you get any big enough group and get them to change, there's an apparent solution to our life. The reality is that's not going to work. What's going to work is we've got to change within. I'd recommend for all of you the five love languages. So discover the way that your partner expresses and receives love, and save yourself a whole pile of drama, because at that level you can start to get it and you can start to get onto the same wavelength. If both of you can read that book, then that's great. But if only one of you reads it, it's a huge start. Okay. Keep the questions coming. So thanks for that, both Bronwyns. Let's go to people in the room here. What stories came up? Oh, microphone behind you. Looks like a hot microphone. So we're not doing stories at the moment, because we can move on if you want. Okay, so we're not doing stories that came up in the moment. What you need to do with that exercise, the purpose of the exercise, is for you to be aware of what it is that you transmit. Because what you transmit in terms of the story, it means what you're going to get is whatever the perfect match for that is. So if what you're transmitting is unlovable, then what you're going to do is you're going to find yourself involved with people unable to express love towards you. If what you're transmitting is happy, then what you're going to find on the other end of that is people who want to experience happiness with you. In other words, you will you will attract who. The law of attraction doesn't say that you are going to get the opposite. Tall people don't get short people. Fat ones don't get skinny ones, although you will see evidence of that everywhere. You'll see, mostly you will see one member of a couple being the life of the party and the other one being the wallflower. That's probably the most common example you'll see. And people say opposites attract, and I would say bullshit. What I would say is that on the surface we look different. Underneath, we're exactly the same. As I looked at Mary and I over the last 40-something years, then what I realise is that on the surface we look so different. You know, I'm the life of the party kind of character, the outwardly ebullient kind of person, the sort of the vociferous, you know, start the dancing on the tables kind of thing. And Mary is the opposite, quiet, shy, retiring, stay in the background kind of thing. If you go past that, if you go deeper than that, what you'll see is that we're exactly the same underneath. We've got the same wishes, same hopes, same desires, same values, same personal truths about life, and we're looking to get connected at that level. When you get down to that level, when you get deep enough in that level, communication doesn't need words. We're here to talk about how to use words and how to listen. What you'll notice is there's two progressions. The first is, this is how to say it. We didn't spend long on that. We spent more time on this is how to listen, which is in silence. So I'm saying communicating is about less about speaking and more about eliciting. But if you go to the next level, it's possible to communicate without words. Could you fall in love with someone who doesn't speak the language? Is it possible that someone from France or Germany met someone from England or Spain and fell in love and they couldn't speak the other one's lingo, but they're able to communicate?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. All right. So let's have a look at another major ingredient to communication, and that's your ability to use emotional intelligence. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this because, in fact, emotional intelligence deserves its own subject. So I'm referring to it now because it'd be madness if we did not refer to it, but it'd be madness to not go and have a look at the work that we've done on emotional intelligence. So we've got plenty of that available in the Success Lab version of Lab Elite. We've also got it available in Lab Elite. I believe we've done a session on emotional intelligence. That stuff is so worth it. If you really want to take yourself to the highest level, you would go and get our certification course on emotional intelligence. It would be one of the best moves you ever made. It's about 17 or 18 lessons, 23 lessons in sequence. You can't get to lesson number 7 without passing the test for number 6. It's a really thorough education system. And emotional intelligence is worth learning from the point of view of it's the only known predictor of future success. You want to do better at anything, relationships, health, wealth, all of it, then what you would do is you would study emotional intelligence. If our stuff is not appropriate, then just go get it on the net. It's not as good and it's not as thorough, and sometimes it's very complicated and very technical, but some education on emotional intelligence is better than none. The more you get, the better. So I'm saying you could almost make a lifelong study of emotional intelligence, particularly in the area of implementing it in your life. I know a lot of people who understand emotional intelligence and are clueless about how to use it. Therefore, using it is probably the main thing to understand there. When it comes to communication with emotional intelligence, pretty much it boils down to
working with the four skills.
So the four skills pretty much boil down to the step number one in emotional intelligence is knowing what you feel. That means being able to put in words what emotions you are experiencing and colour that in for someone. Technically, I would say that until you can describe to another human being capably and accurately and easily what you are feeling, you're probably not up to speed on this one. We, of course, are taught that your feelings are foreign and that you'd be lucky to recognise them. And men in particular are taught that if you just shut up and say nothing, then you don't have to answer this question about what you feel. Consequently, you will find lots of women talking about men not knowing how they feel. My experience is men know exactly how they feel, but they don't have the vocabulary. They haven't been taught how to put this word with that feeling, and the lack of experience is a problem, not the lack of knowledge. Therefore, for most people, it's a question of practice. And that practice boils down to recognizing what you're feeling and recognizing it to the extent that you could actually describe it to another person, or as we say here, that you're able to articulate it comprehensively. That is not just, you know, how do you feel about that? Oh, I feel like shit. That's not emotional intelligence at all. Now, as I'm going to put the four skills on the screen here, we're working from the bottom to the top because I reckon they work on top of each other. These are skills that build on each other. So if you wanted to be highly skilled in emotional intelligence, you would start here and you would spend lots of time on this green box here, recognizing how you feel. A couple of things I'm going to recommend that most people don't bother to do that are really, really going to make a massive difference. One of them you'll have heard me talk about lots and lots before, and that is find 6 times during the day. Now, I actually mean anywhere between 4 and 10, but find a number of times during the day where you can stop. You might have heard me talk about walking out the back door of our house down at the farm. Because there's one step, I've just got myself into the habit of stepping out the door, down one step, the other foot goes beside it, and my rule is that those feet have to stay side by side while I take in the longest, deepest breath that I can, hold it for as long as I can, and then let it out as slowly as I can. Now, I don't reckon that lasts a minute. I'm not that good. But what it allows me to do is to tune into how I'm feeling. So as I take that breath in and out, I focus inwards. Outwards, I notice that I live in paradise because sometimes I'm too busy to notice that I live in paradise. So outwardly, I notice that the wood pile is nice and healthy. That makes me feel, funnily enough, money in the bank doesn't make me feel any different, but the size of my wood pile does. The size of the wood pile is a consequence of me and my friends grabbing the chainsaws and getting out there in the bush and having some fun and bringing home trailer loads worth of wood. For me, that feels wealthy and money doesn't. But if you can kind of forgive me that idiosyncrasy, then what it means is I don't notice unless I stop and notice. So when are the other half a dozen times during the day when you would stop, take a big deep breath in, hold it for as long as you can, and then let it out as long as you can. Maybe when you arrive at work. Maybe when you depart for work. Maybe just before you eat. Maybe when you get in the shower or out. Maybe when you get in bed or out. There's kind of an endless number of times where you could ask yourself how you're feeling. I personally am surprised at how often the answer to how I'm feeling is a bit tense. Therefore, there's an opportunity to let it go. So part of emotional intelligence goes to the second skill. But you can't have the second skill without the first one. So the first one involves recognizing how you feel. The second skill is that how I would choose to feel. So it's the ability to adjust how you're feeling. This is not something you'll have to learn. It's something you'll have to relearn. As a child, you would have had the ability to adjust how you're feeling and come to you automatically. And if you've been around children, you've only got to look at a 2-year-old, decide that they're going to scream the house down and look out the corner of their eye to see who's watching, or that they're going to roll around laughing and celebrating. And that can change from one to the other in a nanosecond. That being the case, then you do actually have the ability to change how you're feeling, but what you're going to have to do is practice. If you don't practice, you can't expect to be any good at it. That is a willingness to put a feeling aside, to say, I feel this, it came to me naturally, but I'm actually going to change it to this. You will find that when you can do that, you have a massive grip over life. Suddenly, your ability to control life goes through the roof. This is vital to communication because what I'm talking about is overcoming the desire to put your point of view. Putting that aside, subjugating that for a while so that you can ask the question that's going to get them to tell you more so that you understand more. So that to become a great listener involves emotional intelligence. It involves a decision to hold yours and hear theirs. And be glad to do that and understand that it's probably long-term a smart move. Short-term, it may not pander to your particular desires. If you practice that, in other words, emotional intelligence is not hard to understand. What you'll see is emotional intelligence is appearing on the screen here like magic right in front of you, but it's not going to appear like magic in your life until you begin to apply it, and that means practicing it. But if you've mastered those two, and I don't know that you ever totally master them, but the better you get with them, the more it makes it available or possible for you to recognize what other people are feeling. If ever I've seen a place where people fall over, it's in this area. I talked earlier, before lunch, I talked about projection. And the automatic assumption that how I feel about something is how you would feel about it. If I've decided how you're going to feel about it based on how I feel about it, it's impossible for me to understand that you might feel differently. That diminishing of emotional intelligence directly impacts on ability to communicate because we just can't understand somebody else. I had a client say to me the other day, I will just never understand why she did that. I said, well, you just predicted the future. You're never going to understand. The truth is, it's not that you're never going to understand. You won't let yourself understand. You won't put yourself in that person's shoes. And because of that, you're dismayed and you can't understand and you never will. Simply because of an act of will. Now, interestingly enough, I'm going to kind of give you some numbers here. I reckon that 50% of the population don't know how they feel and could not answer the question, how do you feel? Of the remaining 50%, I'd reckon half of them can adjust how they feel. You will see lots of people out there saying, I can't help it, I'm just cranky. I can't help it, I'm just sad. I can't help it means I can't adjust it. Now we're down to what percentage of the population? 25% of the population. I'm going to cut it in half again and say, I reckon only half of the remainder can actually accurately recognize what's going on for the people around them. Now we're down to 12.5% of the population have the ability to recognize what's going on for those people around them or people that they just met or whatever. And I reckon the fourth and final skill is going to cut it in half again. So we're down to like 6 or 7, let's call it 7%. About 7% of the population have the ability to be persuasive and influential, to have an impact on how others are feeling. So I've got a question for you. Let's call it 7% in round numbers. I'll wait till you finish writing so that I can ask you this question. That's a very meaningful question. What percentage did we get to? 7%. I want you to take a guess at what percentage of the population can do whatever they want. Take your time with this. What percentage of the population can set a goal and reach it? What percentage of the population can provide themselves with the income they want? What percentage of the population can build the relationship of their dreams? What percentage of the population can be as happy as they want to be? Just take a rough guess.
I reckon 7%.
You reckon 7%? I agree with you.
And if I can just say on the emotional intelligence thing, it's been the greatest change in my life in the last 2 years.
Yeah, biggest change in the last couple of years, emotional intelligence.
Huge. I had up to adjusting your feelings because of the hypnosis work and things that I had done. But going up and starting to work in the higher two levels is just amazing.
Yes, changes everything.
We've
all got a long way to go. In fact, the more you learn about it, you realize how far you've got to go. However, what a journey. What a journey. So congratulations, Chris, and thanks for that. So let me put the last box up there so you can write it down.
Paul, was that 7%? Sorry, 7% of the 7%?
No. You know, we came to 7%, I reckon, have this top-level skill.
Mm.
And put that aside for a second. Now I'm saying, okay, just put that over there. Let's go over here. What percentage of the population have got as much money as they want? I reckon it's about 7%. What percentage of the population have got a beautiful relationship that means everything to them? Probably 7%. What percentage of the population are experiencing the level of health that they want to have given the age that they are? Probably 7%. How many people are really genuinely deeply happy? Probably 7%. I think there's a correlation. Yeah.
The other thing that's just come to mind, Paul, is we have so many different emotional intelligence levels for each area of our life too.
Yes.
I've got some really strong ones in certain areas of my life and they're still horrible in others.
Yes, thanks for saying that, Chris, because what that boils down to is you have different levels of emotional intelligence in different parts of your life. The areas where you have the least emotional intelligence is where you've got the most story. Where the story is still running rampant. And I'll get you guys at home, if you're not really understanding that, then just get into the chat box right now. But essentially, really what I'm saying is that where the story is still running rampant and we haven't got healing, then we're unable to show emotional intelligence in that field simply because the story overpowers us. Yeah, that's a correlation. Write that down because I've never said that before. Story of your life, story of my life too much, story of all of our lives. Okay, so that's emotional intelligence. I'm going to leave it because it's worthy of an entire 4-hour transmission, which we've done, so just go back to that. I do want to talk about conflict resolution in the time we've got left. It's an important concept because conflict's going to come up. You can't actually be involved in the world without having some kind of conflict arise because we all have different values and different views of about what should happen. So I'm going to suggest to you this is a way to look at conflict resolution. This is kind of like a map about how to approach it. So across the bottom, what we've got is this graph. So this map pretty much boils down to the whole idea that if you graph concern for others, in other words, you have to have a sense of concern for other people. But many people's story says that's all I have is concern for others. Those are the people who are in acts of service all the time. The martyrs and those kind of people end up there. You also need to have a concern for yourself. Because a concern for yourself without a concern for others means you're egocentric. That you don't care and you ride roughshod above everybody else. So in resolving conflict, I think this map really helps. And when I get thrown into a situation where conflict needs to be resolved, then I get both sides of the argument before we start to have a look at the map. And then do some explaining. And the explaining pretty much boils down to this. If you are 100% concerned for yourself, then you're a crazy and someone's going to punch you out at some point. If you are 100% concerned for others, you're just going to get walked over. Therefore, there has to be a blend. There has to be a sensible mix of what is good for me and what is good for you. Smart cookies look for win-win. Win-win is not some kind of esoteric, lovely thing. Win-win is smart because if I own a shop, and I want you to come back on more than one occasion, I'm going to price the things in my shop low enough for you to be attracted back and high enough for me to stay in business. What that means is if you're a good customer, you want me to charge more. Because if you're a good customer, let's say I've got a nuts and bolts shop and I've got every nut and bolt in the world in there. Every type of nut and bolt that you could possibly need in there. Getting those things is difficult, but I get them there and I've got them in stock. You, of course, want them as cheap as you can get them. I want to sell them for as much as I can get for them. This is the same as selling a house. The person selling the house wants to get as much as they can. The person buying the house wants to pay as little as they can. This is a natural desire. But people who understand win-win boil down to this. Whose responsibility is it to make sure that my nuts and bolts business stays in business? It's mine from the business perspective. It's yours from the perspective of, do you want me to stay in business or not? If I have this shop in Canberra and I go out of business and you've got to drive to Sydney for one nut or one bolt, then you're crazy because you wouldn't have paid more. Does that make sense? Okay. So where you are the customer, you have a responsibility to make sure that the vendor is getting enough. Does that make sense? Where you are the vendor, you know, you have a responsibility to make sure that the client is getting enough for both people to walk away saying, I would love to keep that relationship going. That's smart. That's not lovely. That's not tickle your armpits with a feather. That's smart. Got it? Therefore, when attacking conflict resolution, understand that if we don't have a concern for others and our sense of self is low, we're going to end up in the there's not a problem thing. You can only help an alcoholic when they're prepared to admit that they're an alcoholic. If they're in denial, we have no solution. Does that make sense? For all of us, that means asking for help may be a barrier we've got to get across, but it could be a bloody good barrier to get across. If you have too much concern for other people, what you'll go for is, let's just make peace. Let's just smooth this over. Let's just brush it under the carpet. Let's all have a cup of tea and pretend it never happened. If you have too much of a concern for yourself, you'll just fight. And this is my mother used to say to me, that's cutting off your nose to spite your face. Does that make sense? So the map is, how do we blend both of these and collaborate and get a win-win? From that perspective, what I'm going to suggest to you is a couple of things. The first thing is, what we need to do when it comes to conflict is effectively convey the situation we find ourselves in and take the time to get the other side of the argument to do the same. In conflict resolution, a lot of it boils down to how compressed can you make the message? Because if it's long and complicated to explain one side of the argument, everyone gets lost. So when I say effectively, what I mean by effective is do this with your hands. How short can you make the message? Right, how much can you compress that message into a short, sharp, powerful, meaningful statement that is easy to understand? Because if it's not easy to understand, we're going to be here for days. In fact, we're not. People are going to get up and walk out. That means going back to what we first did today, which is talking about the five things in preparation to speak, and thinking, how do I get this compressed into the most powerful, punchy delivery that I possibly can? That's dramatically going to increase your chances. Second thing to look at is, okay, so how do we be sensitive and aware? What are the things that I need to be sensitive to and aware of whilst we are communicating about this difficult subject? Sensitive and aware is a question of the bottom line in the graph, awareness for others. Next, the red one, how do I be polite and respectful? This is a direct correlation from sensitive and awareness, and you'll find that conflict resolution is dependent on respect. Where expressions start to creep in along the lines of, you always do that, I'm sick of it, only a deadhead would do that, you're not thinking properly. As soon as respectfulness and politeness goes, so does any chance of a solution. It would appear that in conflict resolution, it's about who's right and who's wrong. The reality is, it's got nothing to do with that and got everything to do with making both sides feel understood. Because if both sides feel understood, the chances are they're going to give some ground. We're not going to give ground when we feel like we're not understood. That make sense? Okay. possibly the most important thing is being able to accurately interpret emotions. That goes back to being an emotional intelligence skill. But if you can't interpret them, then you should ask. I hear what you're saying. Would you mind telling me how you feel about that? I hear what you're saying. Just to be sure that I've got it right, what are the words that describe how you feel about that? Out of respect to your situation, I want to know and not assume. I don't want to jump to conclusions. I want you to tell me rather than me just get it wrong. When you've got all those things in place, what you can do is you can look at seeking common ground. You can now start to look for, okay, what, is there a place where we can find each other out there in the future? In every negotiation, this is the case. I often use a real estate example because it's such an obvious one. The vendor usually wants way more for the house than it's actually worth. The buyer usually wants to pay less than it's actually worth. To get a sale, we've got to create movement of some kind or other. If you try and create 100% movement like that, or 100% movement like that, that's less successful than the common giving off some ground. So that's the secret in negotiation. Right? So conflict resolution doesn't exist without you constantly referring to and using emotional intelligence, because it's about what you can let go and how you can change how you feel and not insist that you are right or correct or have to be this way, or it's, you know, the so-called deal breakers, my way or the highway. Therefore, conflict resolution is going to be difficult if you're not prepared to do two things. The first one is walk a mile in the other person's shoes. But we talked about that all day. Tell me more. Is there any more to that? And then secondly, ditch your righteousness about your position. When you're right, you can actually be the obstacle. One of the most powerful things you can ever come up with is an apology. So I want to talk to you about how to do an apology. Have any of you got a recipe for an apology? Any of you got one that you use?
Sorry.
Sorry is a great start.
On occasion I've said, I'm very sorry that this has happened to you, which doesn't mean that I've caused it.
Yes, but you're not taking blame. Mm. I'm very sorry this has happened to you. So I'm going to give you a formula for an apology that means that the apology has some meaning to the person receiving it. Because what Jason said, sorry, may actually get you a punch in the face. Because if it doesn't look genuine, if it doesn't sound genuine, if it doesn't look like it takes into account all the pain and agony they've been through, even if the pain and agony was self-inflicted, it ain't going to work. So step number one, I am sorry for, and as Sigrid said, you can put anything on the end of that. I'm sorry for how this has turned out. I'm sorry for what I said. Just make it genuine and warm, whatever you're sorry for. When you finish that sentence, take a breath. Apologies need to be delivered gently, warmly, and without a rush. People need time to absorb what's happening, to process it. Therefore, it's good if you can go to the next level and say, this was wrong because. In Sigrid's example, I'm sorry this has happened to you. In my opinion, this never should have happened. It's wrong that this ever happened to you. Doesn't mean you're taking responsibility, but you're aware of the situation. But if it is something that you said or did, you can go further. So if it is actually you, where you've said or done something that's the other side is saying offensive, whether you reckon it's offensive or not, then what you can say is, okay, so in the future, I won't do that. Or in the future, I'm going to blah, 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 blah. This is a promise to modify your behaviour. To be aware of the sensitivities involved. Can you guys see that Rick might use this? For those of you at home, Rick's going, nah! But the reality is, if that person lets loose, Rick, it is, if you feel it, if it's in your heart to say it, then you might actually say, I'm really sorry this has happened. I'm really sorry that you feel this way. I'm really sorry that this has eventuated, if you are. It's wrong that this happened because blah, 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 blah. That makes sense? You probably wouldn't put number three in, but I'd definitely put number four in. For most genuine apologies, the question is not so much the apology. Most people will receive an apology graciously. If you take your time, do it slowly, do it properly, if they can sense that you are genuine about it, then the next question can be, are we able to move beyond this? I've said, can we be okay? But are we able to move beyond this? Not, are you able? Can we rise above this? Can you see a future for us? Is it possible that you can rise above this? That I can rise above it? That we can rise above it? Okay, got an exercise for you to do. At home, you need a pen and paper. You guys can just turn towards each other. So here it goes. This is one of my favourite exercises. So brace yourself. I've saved the best till last. I'm aware that we're up against it time-wise, but I think it's worth it. So we're going to move as quickly as we can. Chris, you got a bolt? Yep, it's 2:02. You said you had to go at 2 o'clock. You're 2 minutes late. Get out of here. Everybody, say goodbye, Chris. Bye, Chris.
Bye, Chris.
Catch you, man.
Thank you. Enjoy your weekend, Chris.
Okay. So, ready? Here's the exercise. Those of you at home, you probably don't even need pen and paper. This is such a killer. The three of you can do all this together. So, bring to mind the last serious argument you had. Explain why you were right, and then explain why you were wrong. Ready, set, go. At home, why were you right and why were you wrong? Ready, set, go. You only need a couple of minutes for this.